This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, continuing with the author and producer, Stephen Moss. His new book is 10 Birds That Changed the World. And now we turn to a raven. I have never seen a raven. I have crows in my life, and I respect them. A raven is much bigger. Also, same cleverness, same intelligence, and the legends. Stephen, a very good evening to you. To continue with the raven, you've seen the raven in the Tower of London. I want to start there because that's part of my association. The Tower of London, it's impossible to avoid it if you read English and American history. The raven is a very large bird, and I take it it has something of the aura of mythology around him. You've met a raven, and he makes a strange sound. So please explain how big and what the sound is and what you thought when you met a raven.
Ravens are like a crow on steroids. I mean, they're considerably bigger. They're about the same size as a hawk, a buzzard, you know, red-tailed hawk, that sort of size. You know, they're a big bird, and they have this very loud, deep call. So they sort of go, rrr. It's where they get their name, actually. It's an onomatopoeic name. It's from an old Norse word, hrafn. And I've met the ravens at the Tower of London. I've been up close and personal with them, with the raven master, who's a wonderful man there, Chris Scaife, who looks after the ravens. And they have this extraordinary mythology to them. And that mythology goes back to early civilizations, the earliest civilizations in North America, in Scandinavia, in the whole of Northern Asia, Russia, Siberia, all the way around the globe. They are the initial sort of bird, if you like. And yet, George R.R. Martin, when he wanted to have a bird as his sort of iconic mythical figure in the Game of Thrones, he chooses the ravens. This is a bird that's still relevant today. And in the tower itself, there is a great myth, and it is a myth, like so many stories in this book. They turn out not to be quite true, or not to be completely true. And the myth of the ravens in the tower is if they ever leave the tower, the kingdom of the United, you know, the United Kingdom will fall. And yet during the Second World War, when England were fighting the Nazis, in fact, before the Americans came in after Pearl Harbor, the Americans, the tower was bombed and the ravens did leave the tower. There were no ravens at the tower for a few weeks until more could be procured. And fortunately, the kingdom did not fall. But I suppose in a way, it's what the raven means to us. You mentioned Edgar Allan Poe, of course, the wonderful poem, The Raven. I think for me, ravens are equal to humans. They're one of the few birds that when you see one, it doesn't look like we're in charge, if you see what I mean. You know, they're big, they're frightening. I absolutely love them. I hear them from where I'm sitting now in my office in Somerset in the west of England. I will hear a raven flying over and calling.
An important detail, the Game of Thrones has used a call that's supposed to be raven. It is a revelation to all the Game of Thrones fans to make a revelation. What is it, Stephen?
Well, I think it's an American crow. It doesn't sound like a raven to me. It's not deep enough. It's like it may be that they've taken, you know, a bit. But this often happens. You know, birders are often watching a television program and you hear completely the wrong bird calling or singing in the background. So I don't know why they haven't used the raven's call, because it's incredible. But you get most other things right in Game of Thrones, to be fair. Spoiler.
It's okay, because everybody who's seen the Game of Thrones now needs to go back and listen to a real raven. You can find
it. They do. But the key thing about the Game of Thrones is the raven's about the only thing in it that doesn't die.
Two ravens are important not only to mythology, but also because the Great Britain, Mother Britain of America, integrated with the Danes, with the Norsemen, with the people who worshipped Odin. And the legend is that Odin had two ravens, Hugin and Munin. And every morning they performed a task for him. What was it, Stephen?
They would fly around the world and come back and tell him what they'd seen. They were his eyes and ears, which is why George Martin uses them, of course. George R.R. Martin knows that story, and he's used the ravens as the all-seeing You know, his ravens are, they see the past, the present, and the future. And he's based that very strongly on that original Viking myth.
Now, the raven is a scavenger, like the bald eagle. And the scavenger means that battlefields and ravens go together. And so do graveyards and ravens, because ravens will feed on corpses. That is part of their world. They're also, I learned from Stephen, regarded as tricksters and independents, completely independent. I take they don't travel in packs. Or is there such a thing as a flock of ravens?
You do sometimes see groups of ravens. Generally, you see individuals or pairs or family groups of three or four. But absolutely, yeah, they are a very independent bird. And they're a bird that I suppose, for me, sums up the independence of birds. They sort of do what they want. They don't do what we want. And I love that about them.
You have lots of Shakespeare, lots of quotes in the book. It's all wonderful because here we are in the 21st century and birds have been part of our history, prehistory, thousands of years. Lady Macbeth, the raven himself is hoarse that croaks the fatal entrance of Duncan under my battlements. I never saw that line jump out at me until you quoted it, Stephen.
Yeah, ravens in Shakespeare. Ravens are generally regarded by most societies and most civilizations in the past and the present as something rather terrifying. You know, they're harbingers of doom, if you like. And of course, the quoth the raven nevermore in Poe. But in some stories of the raven, they're not. Some of the oldest stories of the raven, they've also got a sort of good side. So, and I think they're a bird that's been hugely persecuted, particularly in Britain from the 18th century onwards. And when I was growing up, I would have had to have travelled to Wales or Scotland or perhaps the very west of England to the wild places to see a raven. And now I get them over my house. I've seen them over London. You know, they are a bird that has come back. So they're a really good success story. They're very adaptable, of course.
They were persecuted. From the 17th to the 19th century, the bounty was 4 pennies, which is substantial if you're poor. Why were they persecuted? They killed them.
They were persecuted. Well, and ravens were considered a good bird because, of course, they would have, in Shakespeare's time, they would have cleared up the bodies of mostly animals, but possibly people in London. You know, they were like the cleanup squad, the scavengers, like vultures have been around the world. But when sheep farming became much more lucrative and much more popular in Britain, ravens would come down and eat lambs, or they'd kill sick lambs or whatever. So they suddenly turned from being a good bird to a bad bird, if you like, in our view. And the fact that they would have been also seen on battlefields, as you say, when, you know, as soon as, even before people were dead, they would have gone down and started, I'm afraid, you know, pecking their eyes out and things. So we have a very, very ambivalent relationship with ravens, but I think we need to rehabilitate them because they are glorious birds.
And they're back in numbers in Britain, is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, they're doing really well there.
This is worth a trip just to see it. Meet a raven. I'm speaking with Stephen Moss. He is a producer for BBC, but now the author of a new book, The 10 Birds That Changed the World. We're going to Peru and the cormorant and a revelation of tyranny, great wealth, and puzzlement about modern farming. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with the author and producer Stephen Moss. His new book, 10 Birds That Changed the World, Peru. The cormorant. The cormorant's droppings turn into guano. And this story is so strange, I go immediately to Stephen Moss to help me tell it. The discovery of the guano on these islands, the arid islands, 50 meters deep. I put that all together with who had the breakthrough? When did they have the breakthrough that it was fertilizer, Stephen?
Well, actually, the Incas. So over 1,000 years ago, the Inca civilization in South America knew about guano. Guano is very, like all seabird poo, basically droppings. It is very rich in phosphates and nitrates, and it's very, very good fertilizer. But of course, that had been forgotten with the end of the Inca civilization. And then in the 19th century, a British businessman called William Gibbs, based near where I live, actually in Bristol, he and his partners went over to Peru and harvested this guano. Now, the important thing here is that you mentioned the fact that these were very arid islands. Seabirds live in colonies all around the world. They live off North America, they live off Europe in colonies, but it rains in those places. And so the guano washes away. There's some left, but broadly it washes away. That didn't happen. So there were vast amounts of this guano there. He entered into a contract with the Peruvian government that he would pay them a fee. He would ship this horrible, malodorous, rather dangerous substance back to Britain. And then he sold it to farmers, and he became the richest commoner in England, the richest non-aristocrat in England. He became, I compare him to someone like Bill Gates, because he was also a great philanthropist with the money he earned. The only problem was that the money he'd earned was from guano, which was being harvested by these poor Chinese indentured laborers that had been brought over from China, either thinking they were going to California to take part in the gold rush, or they'd just been fooled and captured and press ganged and brought by ships all the way to Peru across the Pacific Ocean, where they lived and died on these islands. It's a really tragic story, and it means that the wonderful house just up the road from me, Tinsfield, which is a beautiful Victorian house built and created by William Gibbs, full of beautiful objects, is built effectively on the lives of Chinese labourers. So it's a very, very tragic and horrible story.
They worked till they died.
They worked till they died, yeah. And when Peru, like other countries, like the United States and like Britain, abolished slavery, and they did so, I think it was the 1860s, because these men were not classified as slaves, they weren't released.
The story moves from the persecution of Chinese immigrants to the poisoning of the earth, because
yes,
guano is a natural process. I loved it that Alexander von Humboldt noticed something was different in the Lima fields. I thought, von Humboldt, I've read about you. I didn't remember you discovering guano, but now we come to the revelation that you can artificially create fertilizer. I believe that I'm following your reporting, Stephen. 1840 to 1870 is the high point of guano. And then we come to high farming. Two Germans, I believe, Haber and Bosch, what did they discover?
What they did, what happened was there was a great demand as the trading guano fell off, partly because the Peruvians realized that they had this fantastic resource. So people stopped bringing guano to Britain. And by then, farmers had depended on it. They depended on having a fertilizer. Until then, they'd never really had fertilizers. So Haber and Bosch, in the early 20th century, invented synthetic phosphates and nitrates, which then, particularly after the Second World War in Britain and America, kick-started what we call intensive or industrial farming or high farming, where yields were artificially increased, yields of crops in particular, by spreading the land with fertilizers. Now, that's fine, and it's good because it feeds people and farmers need to do that. But unfortunately, it meant that farming became so intensive that, particularly in Britain and Europe and North America, actually particularly in Britain, really, a lot of farmland in Britain is pretty hopeless for wildlife. And we are losing a lot of our wild species. Almost half our bird species are now threatened with disappearing in Britain now, the latest figures show. So, you know, guano was, it did a lot of good things. It created, you know, it stopped people starving by allowing more food to be produced. But we went too far. And that's the problem with that story.
Yes, now I see the birds and the insects decline because of the chemical farming in Britain. That's why the partridge in a pear tree. I've never seen a partridge. Do you still have them?
We do, but not very many. They're a bird that's declined hugely because they are a classic bird of lowland farmland in Britain. And along with many species, and it's happening in the United States with species like the bobolink, species that, birds that depend on farmland are declining. And that's because farming is too intensive. We need to make room for wildlife. So yeah, it's a sad story, and again, as so many of these stories in 10 Birds That Changed the World are, it's a lesson we should have already learned, and yet we seem incapable of learning these lessons.
The butterflies retreat, the beetles retreat, the grey partridges retreat, the skylarks retreat, and then there's this twist. Not until Silent Spring 1962 did we associate this with chemical farming. And at the same time, soil degradation. So the soil is less fertile now because it's been treated as if it was a drug addict.
Yeah,
and had to live since guano. I mean, guano wouldn't have hurt the fields. It was the artificial that hurt the fields.
Yeah, and I think the intensity of it, and you're right, that's a very good analogy. It is like a drug addict. Rachel Carson was so far ahead of her time. Of course, she was pilloried by the industrial farming establishment, if you like, in the United States, and tragically, of course, died of cancer very young before she saw that Silent Spring has become the sort of Bible for environmentalists on both sides of the Atlantic. So that's another very sad story, and she deserves and gets, I think, huge praise for what she did.
There's a twist here too, Stephen. I'm writing my own plot here, but the Second War, following the First War, the Germans used submarine warfare to starve Britain, and you had to go to mass production of food. The U.S. That's had right. to provide mass production of food to supplement what the U.K. wasn't growing for itself. So our warfare, our politics, again, damaged the wildlife that we now mourn has been damaged. We did it.
Yeah, we did it for very good reason. Britons were starving in the war. My mother and grandmother lived through the war, and they would tell me about it, and it was horrendous. But the problem was, after the war, when we could have
right.
re-established farming as less intense, effectively, and still fed the population, because by then, of course, we could then import food. We stopped doing that, and it's a tragedy in Britain, and we're still suffering from it.
10 Birds That Changed the World. Stephen Moss is the author. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with the very generous Stephen Moss, the BBC producer and author of 10 Birds That Changed the World. This next story took my breath away. It's about something humble called the sparrow. We have sparrows everywhere. They sing. This is the tree sparrow, and it's the tree sparrow of Asia, the tree sparrow of China, the People's Republic of China. In December of 1958, Mao Zedong, the leader of the Chinese Communist Party, declared four vermins must be wiped out, rodents, mosquitoes, flies, and the tree sparrow. What follows is astonishing. Stephen, I want to make sure, rodents, mosquitoes, flies, and sparrows, they're not the same thing. But focusing on the sparrow, what kind of sparrow? What did it look like?
It's a bird actually found in Britain. We are used to the house sparrow, which you, of course, have in the United States because it was brought there by mistake. This is a close relative of that. It's not related to the American sparrows, really. It's a seed-eating bird. It was very common in China, in rural and urban areas. Now, what you have to remember about Chairman Mao is, even compared to other dictators like Stalin and Hitler and, dare I say, certain former US presidents, one of the problems with Mao is that he had absolute power. I mean, all dictators are powerful, but he took it to a different level. So when he told 650 million Chinese people to go out and kill the sparrows because they were eating the grain, so he was hoping that by killing the sparrows, the harvest would be bigger, they'd lose less grain, which sounds quite logical. They obeyed him and they went out and did it. The problem he didn't understand, and he was told it very soon afterwards, but he chose to ignore it, was that sparrows, like a lot of seed-eating birds, feed their youngsters, their chicks, on insects. So the following year, when all the sparrows had been killed, there were no, and when we say sparrows, people probably killed most small birds because they're not going to be starting to identify whether it's a sparrow or not. What happened was that the insects had a massive population boom and ate all the harvest. And the figure is disputed, but it is potentially as many as 45 or 50 million Chinese people died in the following year or two from famine. That is more than died globally in the entire First World War. So this is the worst human-created disaster in global history. And yet, as you said to me when we were chatting earlier, most people don't know about this.
I didn't know, and I read a great deal about the People's Republic of China because of the threat here in the 21st century. Let me go through the logic here, if I understand it. The sparrows were not vermin. They were just urbanized. They live in the countryside. They live in the cities. The cities at this time were not dominant in the People's Republic of China. It was a rural population. They lived and died with sparrows. The opinion of the Chinese peasants, the people who lived in the country, was you only eat sparrows during times of famine. There's the irony in all directions here, Stephen.
Yeah. And I had this extraordinary meeting, which I describe in the book. I met a half English, half Chinese woman called Esther Chow Ying, who was there in 1958-59 and worked for the English language radio station in what is now Beijing, Peking. And she said, this is a stupid idea. We shouldn't kill the sparrows. It's going to end in tears. She was not quite the only person who said that, but one of a tiny minority. Esther still lives. I spoke to her grandson yesterday. Esther is still thriving at the age of 91, lives in North London, and is just a remarkable, delightful, and extraordinary woman who basically contradicted Chairman Mao. And you did not do that.
No.
And she did, and she lived to tell the tale. And of course, as one of her colleagues said many years later, she said, I was right, wasn't I? And the colleague said, you were right, Esther, but at the wrong time, which is a very, you know, concerning comment, because of course people contradict dictators. They have doing it now in Iran, for example, and they get arrested, they get killed, you know, even though they're right. And this is, you know, this is she was extraordinary and she survived, but many, many millions of people did.
Yes, let's talk to two ornithologists who were at the Peking National History Museum. They're the ones who were responsible for making this connection right away. 1958, yes. They made it. Zhu and Cheng. Cheng is the founder of Chinese ornithology today. They were at the academy, and they had a sparrow stomach open, and they saw it was mostly insects. So they made the connection, and they took it to the authorities, thinking the authorities would not just reward them, but would understand how dangerous this was. And instead, I don't know, were they persecuted? Yeah, they were persecuted. They were.
Yeah, they lost their jobs. They were sent to rehabilitation camps. You know, they were treated appallingly. And you know, they did survive and they did get through. But as you say, you know, this is what happens in dictatorships. This is what is happening, I'm afraid to say, in America now. And it's happening in Britain now, that it's no use being right. We are saying to our government, you need to deal with the climate crisis. People are saying that in America. Probably the majority of people in America and Britain think this, and yet governments, for whatever reason, don't want to hear. And that was Mao's problem. No one actually, of course, no one dared go to Mao and say, look, these two scientists have proved that we mustn't do this, because they would have lost their jobs. You know, this is the problem with fear, problem with governments of fear.
I also read into this, Stephen, something else about the public, because once they were given this direction by Mao, they threw themselves into it with a fever that's not rational. that you cited there was one young man who was rewarded in the newspapers because he'd strangled 20,000 sparrows.
Yeah.
That's nutty.
Yeah, it's insane. And most of the birds weren't killed, actually, by shooting them or strangling them. They were mostly killed, particularly in cities, by people going around for 2 days and two nights bashing pots and pans and, you know, blowing trumpets and making a noise. And the sparrows would fly up every time they found a flock of sparrows, and they're a very sociable bird. They would fly up in the air, and they literally, after 2 days, they died. You know, they were exhausted. They fell to the ground in their thousands. And it shows just how quick it is. This wasn't something that took 6 months or a week even. It was really a few days. And, yeah, people like that man did that. But the consequences, you know, it is heartrending to read. I'm sorry, you know, people reading this book. There are some very positive stories in this book, and there are some very positive outcomes. But that story, I think, is the best story in the book, and it's the one that is the most awful. Really.
Well, it is Maoism, and Maoism hasn't left us, Stephen. So let's go to Australia again. Remember, everything is exotic and will try to kill you. Not the emu. What is an emu?
Emu is basically the second or third largest bird in the world after the ostrich. It depends. It's taller than a cassowary, but not as heavy. So it's one of these big flightless birds, really big. You know, taller than, as tall as a human being.
60 kilograms. Good heavens. It can run 50 kilometers per hour.
Yeah, it's a terrifying bird. And what happened was that emus live, they're nomadic, because like a lot of creatures in Australia, they have to follow the rains. You know, food is not necessarily in the same place at the same time. And what happened in Western Australia, this is a sub story in the tree sparrow story, partly for humor, actually, because it's a very funny story. That in the 1930s, a whole load of soldiers, Australian soldiers from the First World War, who were on hard times, were given houses and land in Western Australia, effectively on the edge of the desert, so that, you know, they could be compensated, and so that they would you know, start up a new economy there. And what happened was the emus came in one day, big, large numbers of this very sociable bird, net all the crops. So the Australians sent the army in to kill them all with machine guns, only it didn't work because the emus were very clever and they would split and they would, you know, it's almost like they were, you know, like a proper army does, you know, it uses tactics and strategy. And the emus won the war. It's called the Emu Wars. It's the only example of a bird winning a war against human beings, and it's a great story.
Do the Australians admit to this, Stephen? When you
they did. No, to be fair on the Australians, they did. I mean, there's a famous story that one of the MPs stood up and said, "Well, we do need, of course, we should be giving the soldiers, the human soldiers who fought in this war, medals, campaign medals, because you always get a medal, as you know, if you fight in a war." And another man stood up and said, "If we're going to give any medals at all, let's give them to the emus." Because they won.
It's a wonderful story. It's a way of dealing with the foolishness of mankind when he examines the forest or the desert and says, maybe we can interfere, maybe we can intervene. And the intervention in China is the great leap forward. That mass murder was direct consequence of Mao intervening in Mother Nature. You report that the next year they imported 250,000 tree sparrows from the Soviet Union in order to reestablish the ecosystem. Extinction is the term. Climate crisis is upon us. Stephen Moss is the author. 10 Birds That Changed the World. We're turning next to the snowy egret and the emperor penguin. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm with Stephen Moss. I'm John Batchelor. His new book is 10 Birds That Changed the World. First, the snowy egret, a beautiful bird to look at photographs. The plumage wars. This had to do with fashion, maybe from Marie Antoinette, but certainly by the 19th century in Europe and in America. Ladies' hats. Stephen, there's a part of the story that's hard to tell about the abuse of birds with beautiful plumes like the snowy egret. We've changed, Stephen. There's no toleration for this kind of cruelty today.
I hope not. I mean, people still shoot birds, certainly in Europe and America, you know. But what happened here was, as you say, this was driven by I suppose, what you'd call posh rich women in New York, in Paris, in London. They wanted to outdo their friends, and they did so, first by wearing ostrich feathers, which were farmed, so that was less of a problem, but then from feathers of wild birds. And not just feathers, people would wear things like a hummingbird as a brooch on their, you know, a dead one on their dress. And the demand for feathers was huge. And of course, where there's demand, there's money to be made. And so men in Florida, ordinary men, would go out and they would kill these birds like snow egrets that live, that nest in big colonies. So you could go in with a boat and you could perhaps kill hundreds of birds in one go. And then they would sell perhaps for a dollar or two each pile of feathers. But those feathers were ultimately sold at prices equivalent to the same weight as gold. So this was a massive industry. Huge industry. People were making big profits. And then one day, a young man called Guy Bradley, who'd been he'd helped the shooters himself when he was young, but late 30s, he'd become a warden, become a ranger in the early days, encouraged by people like Teddy Roosevelt, who was a remarkable conservationist in his own right. As well as being president. And so Guy Bradley confronted a man and his sons who were collecting the egrets. He caught them red-handed and they shot him. They shot him dead. And this story from Florida went up to New York. It went across to LA and San Francisco. It went to the big cities in America and caused outrage. And it eventually took another 20 years, but it led to the end of the plumage industry because people were so shocked by this.
Simultaneously or in parallel, there's the development of what we in America call the Audubon Society and what in Britain is the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, although there was another founding group called the Fur Fins and Feathers Folk. I love that one.
They joined forces with the Society for the Protection of Birds to eventually become the Royal Society, as you say. But these were, again, what was great about this was these societies were, Audubon and RSPB, were started, founded, run, and promoted by women. And this was a time, certainly in the United Kingdom, where women did not have the vote for another 20 or 30 years. And I think the same is true in the United States. So these women were outraged by the cruelty of these poor birds dying in their millions, and also the fact that they were going to eventually go extinct. And the snow egret nearly followed the dodo and the grey auk and the passenger pigeon down that line. So these women were very, very determined, and they started these societies that we are still members of and still love today.
Yes, the American Audubon Society, National Audubon Society, is a product of those hats. And the hats went away when an influencer, we say today, had her hair cut into a bob, and the hats went away. I've often wondered about the hats that I've seen. Where did they come from? And I went and saw a picture of a woman dressed up at the turn of the century, and there was a snow egret feather right out of the top of her hat. Your book makes me see things I've always seen but not understood, Stephen. So let's go now to a story of climate crisis. This has to do with the emperor penguin of the Arctics and how the expectation is 98% extinct by 2100. I think I get that. That's nearly extinct. It's too much.
That means they'll be doomed. And this is in Antarctica. Again, the parallel with the dodo is incredible because the dodo, everyone thinks the dodo was stupid because it couldn't fly. But of course, it wasn't stupid in context. It had evolved for tens of thousands of years to live on an island where there were no predators. So it was fine. Now, the predator now is humanity, and we're not killing the emperor penguins. We're not going and shooting them or harvesting them, or we're not releasing rats or dogs into Antarctica. But what we are doing is by creating the climate crisis, and I'm glad you used that term. It's a term we try to use here now rather than climate change. We are leading a bird that is evolved to nest and breed in the Antarctic winter. You may well have seen it on David Attenborough documentaries on PBS and things. This extraordinary bird that's been doing absolutely fine until now. It's still There's still big numbers of emperor penguins. I saw one many years ago. I went all the way to Antarctica and saw one. But there are big colonies of them, but they are deeply threatened, and they're not the only thing. Lots of birds that migrate through the eastern seaboard of the USA and Canada, lots of birds in Europe, particularly migrants, particularly birds that nest in the Arctic, where things are changing very rapidly, just as they are in the Antarctic, are massively under threat now. And it's a terrible cliche. We use the cliche in Britain, the miner's canary, because coal miners used to take a canary down the mine, because if the canary was sitting on its perch, if it fell off its perch, it was because there was gas that the canary would react to first, and the miners knew they had to get out very quickly or they too would die. That is what this penguin is. You know, penguins and these other birds that I mentioned in the last chapter of 10 Birds That Changed the World are the equivalent of the miner's canary. And if we don't listen, we are doomed.
The temperature changes are not just in the Antarctic or the Arctic. They're also on hillsides and cloud forests. And that very much affects birds that we have here in North America, you have in Europe. The warblers are damaged because their insects move with the temperature.
That's right. So birds, insects react rather more quickly than birds do. So migratory birds tend to come back at the same time every year, whether that's in North America or Europe, because they winter in the southern hemisphere. They wait till the day length changes, which of course is constant. That isn't changing because of the climate crisis. And they head north. But the trouble is, by the time they get back to the eastern states of North America or the western states or Europe or Britain, those insects have already been and gone. You know, they've come out a month earlier. And what we're doing is we're messing with the biological world, if you like, in a way that we can't predict what the results will be. But what we can predict is that a few species that are very adaptable, like the raven, will be fine. But most species, like the emperor penguin, won't.
We have 30 seconds, Steve. Stephen, you have a concept called apocalypse fatigue. What is that?
That's the idea that we have heard so much about climate change and it's so huge and so terrifying that we can't grasp it. I am an optimist. I have to be an optimist. And my optimism says that we will, at the 11th hour, we will realize that when we mess with birds, when we mess with wildlife, it bites us back. That's the theme of this book. That's what I've been trying to say. And thank you for being, so incisive and, insightful into what I'm trying to say, the message I'm trying to get across.
Got to meet a raven. Before I move on, Stephen, I have to meet a raven. So
John, you are very welcome to come over here and I will show you a raven.
The 10 Birds That Changed the World. Stephen Moss is the author. I'm John Batchelor.